from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a huge column of Iraqis on the march today, not of soldiers, but of religious Shia pilgrims, converging on the holy city of Karbala. It was the first time in 25 years that Iraq Shias had been permitted to make the pilgrimage, and the pilgrimage is just one face of a great Shia rising in Iraq. Shia Muslims make up 60% of Iraq's population. After years of repression under Saddam Hussein, they are making a claim on power. Washington is watching. Tonight, On Point, the explosive emergence of Iraq's Shia Muslims. We begin tonight at the pilgrimage site in Karbala, 50 miles southwest of Baghdad. Masses of Shia Muslims gathered for a second day today to commemorate the martyrdom 13 centuries ago of Hussein, grandson of Islam's prophet Muhammad. Benjamin Lowy is a photographer for Time magazine. He was in Karbala in the sea of celebrating Iraqi Shia. I asked him to describe what he saw.
There's a massive amount of Shia Muslims that have congregated in Karbala for the first time really in 35 years since Saddam Hussein, the Ba'athist Party, came to power. And what you have is just massive amounts of people. I mean, the estimates are somewhere in between 4 and 5 million, just crowding streets in processions that have lasted all of yesterday, all night long, all today. There's self-mutilations with swords. There are people beating themselves with chains, with their hands, going through the streets in this kind of frenzied religious fervor that I've never seen before.
Ben, how are they dressed and where are they going? Is there one particular shrine that they proceed to?
Well, there are two large mosques here, and basically they leave these parades in the streets with circles around them, but they end up traveling throughout the entire city on the major roads. There's so many people here that their parade's going at all times, and it's just clogged with worshippers. In terms of what they're wearing, I mean, it's just normal garb that's just ripped off or torn to shreds. I've never seen anything like it. It's quite unbelievable. This is the closest, as a non-Muslim, that I would ever probably get to see something in the realm of, like, the Hajj. But they don't even have something in the terms of self-mutilation. This is a very Shia-oriented holiday.
Our images of the Hajj in Mecca are of masses of people, but carefully bathed, dressed in white, quite orderly in their procession around the Dome of the Rock. Describe what you've seen through your lens today.
This is anything but orderly. It's just crowds and crowds of people surging forward. What they do more than anything else is hit themselves with their hands. And if you could hear the sound, there's a thumping sound throughout the city, and it's just that the sound of hands hitting their chest. And it's so many hands hitting so many chests at the same time. You just hear this rhythmic. It's almost like a drum. And they just march through the streets, surging into stores and buildings and into each other.
Can you describe their chant or what they're saying to us?
It's about the martyrs Hussein and Ali and what happened here all those years ago. And this uniting of Islam and martyrdom is the mourning of their death.
You described self-mutilation and people hitting themselves. Are they actually injuring themselves?
Oh, I'm right now splattered. I'm covered in blood, and it's not my own. They use swords, and they cut their heads with swords. They slice their heads, and they walk through the streets, slicing their heads with these long daggers. Blood streaming down their faces, on their clothes, everywhere, all over other people. They also have a whole procession of people flogging themselves with, like, a chained mace.
Do you see people lying by the road, actually so injured that they're falling down?
There was one case where the crowd lifted up someone whose head had been just too split open and was dehydrated, and they rushed him forward and pulled him through the crowd. But other than that, they have not seen a lot of people so injured that they couldn't go on. There seems to be a well-managed system for people who self-mutilate themselves or taken to a slide area and cared for before they go back out.
What about at the end of the day? What's nighttime look like there?
It has not cleared up here at all. It was expected to, but the streets are just still full of people going on these large, large parades of mourners, and it is not stopping, again, because it is the first time that this particular ethnic group has been allowed to do this in Iraq for 35 years. It was supposed to end tonight, but I think it's going to continue as it did last night, all night long, and tomorrow.
Benjamin Lowy is a photographer for Time magazine. He spoke with us from Karbala, Iraq. Shia Muslims proclaim that Hussein, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, was martyred 1,323 years ago at Karbala. Tradition says that armed with a sword in one hand and the Quran in the other, he faced an army of 4,000 opposing Muslims and fell. Today in Karbala, up to 2 million Shia Muslims from Iraq, Iran, and other nations converge to atone for the sins of their ancestors who failed Hussein. The gathering demonstrates more than fierce religious zeal. The Shia are also a political force that has been waiting for a voice in a new Iraq. Are we seeing another Islamic Republic a la Iran being born on the streets of Karbala? How will a U.S.-administered Iraq deal with the newly released energy of the long-suppressed Iraqi Shia? And can Iraq deal with Shia, Arab Sunni, and Kurdish Sunni ambitions without flying apart? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Mahmoud Ayeb, professor of Islamic studies at Temple University and author of Redemptive Suffering in Islam, a study of the devotional aspects of Ashura in Twelver Shiism. Good evening and welcome, Mahmoud Ayeb.
Thank you very much. Good evening to you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. Mahmoud Ayeb, I wish you could just step back for a minute. There's a lot to talk about tonight, but can you give us some perspective on what we just heard described in Karbala today? Masses and masses of devout Shia converging on that city, chanting, marching, lots of energy and devotion being expressed, self-flagellation, self-injury. What's moving this?
It is an ethos that goes back to the time of Ali, the son-in-law and cousin of the Prophet, who was an ideological man, an idealistic man who wanted to establish, to continue the rule of the Prophet in Medina. And he was assassinated. His older son, Hassan, is reported to have been killed, poisoned by the reigning Umayyad caliph, Muawiyah. Mm. And when Muawiyah died, his son, Yazid, succeeded him, who was not acceptable to the Muslims in general. So Hussein was the younger son of Ali, was called to Iraq to lead an insurrection against Yazid. And the same people who called him betrayed him, and he had to face an army of about 4,000 with about 70 men, and they were all massacred on the 10th day of Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, in 61 AH, that is 680 CE.
Christian era. And so today we come to Ashura, which celebrates...
Happened actually 40 days ago.
I'm sorry, yes, we're 40 days after Ashura today.
Yeah. Now, if I may be allowed a minute to sketch the beginning of this particular celebration. The surviving son of Hussein and his womenfolk were taken captives first to Kufa, the capital of Iraq, then, and then to Damascus. But Yazid felt that what his governor in Iraq did was going too far, so he returned them to Medina. On the way back, they stopped in Karbala, and it so happened that they did that on the 40th day after Ashura, after the death of Hussein, and they met one of the venerable old companions of the Prophet, and together, according to tradition, they instituted the pilgrimage of the 40th day, as we now see in Iraq. Now, my own feeling, sir, is that probably Saddam did not completely forbid the celebration.
But in 1977, he massacred lots of Iraqis on the way to Karbala, and Iraq has seen nothing like what we saw today in all those years since.
Exactly. What he did is he curtailed it completely. But he couldn't have completely forbidden it because it is a tradition. And if I may say so, the death of Hussein is regarded as a tragic event by all Muslims, Shiites and Sunnis, but only for the Shiites. It became an ethos of suffering and martyrdom. And what we see people mutilating themselves and so on is in order to participate even vicariously with the sufferings of the members of the family of the Prophet, Hussein and his followers and family members.
Mahmoud, I have, so what you describe here is a kind of very, very early split in Islam, a huge dispute that goes on to this day over lineage and leadership of the faith. But it leaves us wondering, in 1977, why would Saddam Hussein have cared to massacre Shia on the way to Karbala? Why was there such a threat? And we understand that he even banned this kind of ritual self-flagellation, even just the beating of chest, let alone the more the more damaging things. What were these symbols of that a ruler like Saddam Hussein found necessary to crush?
Well, to understand this, you see, most important Shia intifadas, if you like, revolts throughout history happened, either started during the this time, the time of Ashura and the, into the 40th day, or in the name of Hussein. The Iranian Revolution began really in 1963 when Khomeini led an uprising in on Ashura and he was exiled.
You're talking across the border in Iran, where there's also an enormous Shia majority and where the Shias ultimately proclaimed the Iranian Islamic Republic.
I will come to that. And so any outpouring of emotions like this could scare a ruler, particularly one like Saddam, who was ruthless to everyone, including his own family members. And so the idea of banning flagellation and self-injury, many of the Shia ulama would like to ban it as well, but they cannot prevail.
That's the Shia leadership. And let me ask you this. The Shia are 60% of Iraq's population.
Probably a little more.
Perhaps more. Yeah. But yet the Sunni Muslims have been the dominant group for a long, long time. Why?
You see, this is another problem that I wonder when the Bush administration embarked on this venture, they really knew what they were doing. All the Gulf states are ruled by a Sunni minority. Bahrain has a Shia majority. Saudi Arabia does not have a Shia majority, but it has a very large Shia community, which is kept out of power. And Iraq was part of that pattern, partly also because the Shias in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, up to the time of the collapse of the monarchy, they decided not to get involved in politics. And now they see that had they been involved in politics, they wouldn't have paid such a high price, you know. So they have become politicized.
Can Iraq have a politicized Shia majority and still hold together?
That is for time to tell. There are sober voices in Iraq. Iraq is not Iran. Iraq has an Arab Shia population with a different kind of history.
That is opposed to the Persian Shia in Iran.
Right. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, actually, the two centers of learning, Najaf and Qom, were not always in harmony, sometimes in competition.
That is Najaf in Iraq, Qom in Iran.
In Iran. And so it's not a foregone conclusion that the Iraqi Shias rule, they will make a republic like that of Iran. I mean, they would have to be close to Iran because Iran remains the major Shia power and Shia country in the world.
Mahmoud, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Yeah. Listeners, you can join this conversation. We're talking about the explosive emergence of the Shia Muslims of Iraq. How will a U.S.-administered Iraq deal with the newly released energy of the long-suppressed Shias? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the explosive emergence of the Shia Muslims of Iraq. I've been joined by Mahmoud Ayoub, professor of Islamic studies at Temple University and author of Redemptive Suffering in Islam, a study of the devotional aspects of Ashura in 12-er Shiism. You can join the conversation as well. Do the passions in the streets of Karbala today look compatible with democracy? Is it a raw display of democracy that we've seen today? Is Washington ready and able to deal with Islamic religious fervor in Iraq? And can Iraq deal with its Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish ambitions without flying apart? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to welcome into our conversation now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Juan Cole. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. Good evening and welcome, Juan Cole.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Juan Cole, what are you thinking in these last days, even more than a week now, where we've seen in the aftermath of war and the dethroning of Saddam Hussein, a tremendous outpouring of Shia energy aspirations and not infrequently anti-Americanism? What does all this portend? Is this worrying? Is this just to be assumed? Can this be part of an Iraq that conforms in any way to what Washington appears to be hoping for?
Well, I think it does not conform to an Iraq that Washington is hoping for. I think Washington has been consumed with a fantasy about Iraq, and now it's meeting the real thing, and it doesn't look the same. I think there are several things to keep in mind. One is that the people we see on television and we hear about with regard to the religious demonstrations are probably not the majority of Iraqi Shiites, or if they are, they're a bare majority.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a very large number of middle-class intellectuals, of working people at factories and so forth, who are Shiite, but who are relatively secular in their orientation.
So you're saying don't think of all Iraqi Shias as chanting, marching, cutting themselves, that kind of expression. Of course, we know, I mean, there are counterparts in the Christian world in certain cultures, certain times of the year where things can get pretty dramatic, but that's in the Christian world also a kind of marginal observance. You're saying it's the same thing here.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably that kind of demonstration of religious devotion is probably more widespread in Iraqi Shiism mm-hmm. than it would be in Western Christianity. But it's nevertheless, not everybody does it. And if you look at a city like Basra, which is 1.2 million, it's the second largest city, it's a mainly Shiite city, relatively little in the way of religious organizations or demonstrations have emerged there. And it seems to have a more secular orientation so far, at least.
Juan Cole, what are you anticipating now that the cork is out of the bottle? Shias are very publicly engaged with post-war Iraq and its prospects. What do you think the Shia leadership, the Shia population will push for?
Well, I think what has happened is that the United States came in with a relatively thin force on the ground, not enough to really control the country, and it knocked the fragile Ba'ath rule down. And it was the religious parties and personalities who were organized enough and, frankly, who had militias who were able to step into that vacuum. In places like Najaf and Kufa, in the great Shiite slum areas of eastern Baghdad, what is now called Sadr City, it's these religious groups that have provided the local neighborhood law and order through these militias. So this has put the religious parties into a very powerful position, and I do not think it will be easy to disarm those militias. I do not think it will be easy to turn people back from their loyalty to some of these religious personalities. Mm-hmm. And so it may well be that the way the United States went in there gave an opportunity to the religious parties to establish an early lead in shaping the new country. And they are, devoted to a relatively theocratic program. They would like a religious government based on Shiite law, that's not going to be acceptable to the Sunni Arabs or to the Kurds.
Not all the Shias either, but Anyhow, let me say good evening to my friend. Hi.
Mahmoud, it's so wonderful to hear your voice.
Mahmoud Ayoub, one call.
Yeah.
Mahmoud Ayoub, what's your view? No, is the Shia energy compatible with Washington's hopes?
Yeah, I want to back up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I want to say that we have, in some ways, a poor image of Iraq, and which does not conform to the reality of the country. Iraq, until very recently, even during the rule of Saddam, had the highest literacy rate.
Mm-hmm.
It was a country that was industrialized and self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very large intellectual elite in Iraq. And so I think the
And by
Iraqis,
reputation, it was quite secular.
Yeah. Towards the end of his regime, he started kind of banking on religious slogans, which didn't help. But I think that there is a strong secular voice in Iraq that even I heard the other day Muhammad Baqir al-Hakim, who is the son of an earlier Ayatollah, very well known, and who is now has been in Iran all these years. He said, I think that our idea of establishing an Islamic Iranian-style republic in Iraq will not work. We want an Iraq that is open for all.
So you're suggesting, Mahmoud Ayoub, that despite these passionate displays we've seen in Karbala, and despite the fairly fierce statements of some leading Shia figures, that they're going to want to come to a table and work together with Sunni Arabs, Sunni Kurds, and have a kind of federal republic, not an Islamic republic?
I don't see it happening so smoothly, but I think it is conceivable. But also I want to say that see, many Iraqis, as I hear on the Arab satellite TV channels interviewed, they do not trust the United States. They quote their earlier Ayatollahs like Muhammad Baqir Sadr and so on, who always lumped the United States with Israel, and it's all the United States are in Iraq for the oil and so on. So the United States will have a hard time demonstrating its goodwill. So far, they haven't done very well, but hopefully they will do better.
One call. Help us think about what appear to be options here. I mean, one option, and I hear it kind of being dismissed, but one option is a theocratic state, an Islamic state along the lines of Iran. Another option, I guess, is that this descends into civil war between Sunni Shia. Another option is that it goes, well you tell us, what are the positive options here? What are the negative, and how are you thinking about how all this energy is likely to be channeled, how this is likely to work out?
Well, I mean, I agree with Mahmoud that as a practical matter, if the religious Shiite parties want to remain in a united Iraq, then they're going to have to trade horses with the Sunni Arabs and the Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm afraid of is that they may not realize how incompatible some of their demands are with living together with the Sunnis and the Kurds. Sometimes people are not clear-sighted about how much other people object to their points of view.
For example, a Shia Islamic State.
Yes. Well, for instance, Shiite law and Sunni law are not exactly the same thing.
Mm. But they're close.
Most of these religious parties on the Shiite side are saying they want Ja'fari or Shiite law to be the basis of Iraqi law.
Are they close enough that the impulse for an Islamic Republic could take over and the two would be compatible within that? Is it possible?
No, I think the only way you could do it to make it compatible is this way. If you had a relatively secular constitutional and civil law, but then you had religious law for personal status matters like marriage and burial and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and that religious law for personal status matters was according to the right of the person involved. So there would be Shiite law for Shiites and Sunni laws for Sunnis, Christian law for Christians.
But who would be the Ayatollah, who would be the religious figure at the top of this theocratic state?
Well, what I'm saying is that you couldn't have an Ayatollah at the top of it. You'd have to have
I'm sorry to agree with my friend. I think that this scenario that one call is describing is what really operates in many countries, including Iran. In Iran, although the majority are Shia, there are Hanafis and Shafi'is, and they all follow their own law. Law is not the issue. And Shia or Ja'fari law is not very much different from Sunni law on most points. They come from the same sources.
But the Shia majority is much greater in Iran than in Iraq.
No, but you see, I think that the problem in Iraq is that you have many ethnic and confessional groups, and where they have sometimes conflicting identities. Mm-hmm. Probably the best case scenario, if it can be imposed by, in some way internally or whatever, would be to have a federated Iraq, where the Kurds will have self-rule in the north, the Shias in the south, the Sunnis, where they are in Takrit and Kirkuk and those areas, and all being part of a central authority in Baghdad that is multi-religious.
But one wonders about that. I mean, you look at the map, and there are, despite those general gatherings, concentrations, there are large areas where these populations overlap. One thinks of the partition of India and wonders if something similar might not happen. Juan Cole, please stand by a moment. Ayub, callers want to join us, and I want to invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Muldafa is calling from Boston. Hi, Muldafa. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just need to make a couple points that the concept of secular or secular government is totally different in Islamic State than in Western states. So I disagree with the professor from Michigan of his description of the Shiite conflict with Sunnis or whatever.
Well, are you saying that you think they could live together
Absolutely. And the reason for that...
In a secular state, Muldafa, or an Islamic state or some hybrid?
Some of both. If we take the secular concept, it cannot be applied totally the Western style.
But it has been in Iraq, hasn't it? Historically, haven't there been secular governments there?
No, it was more of a dictatorship. And don't forget, Saddam used religion to invest in his power, especially to make a public view to the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
But other than this, I mean, the Shiite themselves, the civil law, which is state by religion, the differences with the Sunni are very little. And I do disagree with describing what's going on in Karbala as a pilgrim. It's a visit. And also, it's making a political statement as well as a religious statement.
You're saying it's not a pilgrimage, but I'm not sure the distinction you're making. People are walking many miles to get there, some of them on their knees. It sounds like a pilgrimage.
I can tell you the difference. The pilgrim is what's called fariba, which means one of the principal
or
in Islam. But visit Hussein is mostly, it's 90%, put it this way, is a political statement.
Yeah.
Those people who follow Hussein or follow the principle of which Hussein died for, which is standing against all the unjust, it's mixed up with ritual to keep the memories alive.
Fair enough. Muldafa, let me just ask you, are you Iraqi?
Yes, and I'm Shiite as well.
And what are you expecting? Do you imagine a kind of secular federation in Iraq? Do you anticipate an Islamic state?
I would say this. For civil laws, it has to be an Islamic laws, which can combine all Muslims in Iraq, so whether they are Shiite or Sunni or Kurdish, because they all, in their everyday life, they do practice this civil principle or civil laws apply to them.
Muldafa, thank you for your call. Juan Cole, you're challenged a bit there, and I guess I also want to come back and ask you how this view that keeps arising here how it possibly meshes with American hopes or Washington Bush administration hopes and expectations in Iraq?
Well, I think there's probably a consensus among many Shiites in Iraq that they want Shiite law to be the basis of the state. I have to say that I deeply disagree respectfully with the caller and with my colleague. I think if you asked most Sunnis in Iran if they're happy being under Shiite law and Shiite rule, they would loudly say no, and the Kurds would say that they have faced pogroms. And I don't believe that if you had a Sunni Arab or a Kurd on your show, that they would in any way agree to such a framework. Mm-hmm. So I think there's trouble brewing over this. I think you've put your finger on a very important issue. I think the issues can be worked out, but so far we haven't even gotten the important people to the table. For instance, several of the Shiite organized religious parties have refused to come to leadership meetings sponsored by Jay Garner, because he's working out of the Pentagon, and they say they won't cooperate with the U.S. military occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in order even to get to first base, this operation of reconstructing Iraq has to be given to the State Department. And at that point, you might be able to get some of the major Shiite players to come, at least to come to the conferences and begin working out a compromise.
It should
and
be
I think
given
it will
to
be a
the
compromise.
United Nations, not to the State Department. The U.S. will not be able to do it.
But you know, Mohamed Ayoub, the U.S. appears fairly determined to do it. And
well,
you can well imagine that Washington will attempt to insist on a kind of secular federation at the least.
Whenever history repeats itself, it makes more mistakes. The British tried in 1917 and used every means to subdue the Iraqis, and they could not. And the Americans will not be able to do it. If the Americans really want to help the Iraqis, they should involve the United Nations and let them do the work, and they can help in many ways. Then they will be thanked as liberators, but now they are seen as occupiers.
But the Bush administration is saying there's no need to turn this over to an international committee, to the UN, that it can be turned directly over to Iraqis. And, of course, Washington won't consider this subjugation, but rather helping Iraq to get toward a kind of balanced secular state that can profit the Iraqi people, Mahmoud Ayoub.
I want to say something very basic. I do not think that secularism and democracy are the alternative religions to religion. I think that the Iraqi caller had a very important point. In every Muslim country, there are Shiites and Sunnis who live under their own respective laws, because the Islamic law is not applied except in Saudi Arabia. Except in laws of personal status, which could be anything. But the law of the state, even in many Muslim countries, is civil law. And so I think that, again, I go back to my original point.
Mm.
The problem in Iraq is ethno-religious identities. The Kurds are not a different breed. They are Sunnis also. Mm. There are a few Shiite tribes as well. So the problem, as I see it, is that the Sunni Arabs, as a minority, have a hard time. But what may happen in Iraq, unless we do something wise and good and with good ulterior motives, is that Iraq could divide into little cantons. You know, the Kurds will take the north, and then they will have to battle with Turkey. The Turks would also want the Turkoman places, and that will create a different problem. Then the Shiites will be in the south. Where would be the Sunni Arabs, and where would be the oil wells?
Mahmoud Ayoub, hold it there, if you would, please. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the explosive emergence of the Shia Muslims of Iraq. Do the images from Karbala today bode well for the U.S. project in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the explosive emergence of the Shia Muslims of Iraq. How will a U.S.-administered Iraq deal with the newly released energy of the long-suppressed Shia? And what is Washington getting into here? What is Iraq getting into here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Mahmoud Ayoub, professor of Islamic studies at Temple University, joining us from Philadelphia. And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of Sacred Space and Holy War. Harry's joining us right now. Welcome, Harry. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I have been listening to especially the last speaker, and it seems that we are looking there in the way he's been talking at sort of the worst possible fears. I just wonder if we shouldn't be thinking about the fact that the Islamic government, for example, in Iran, has generally been accepted to be a failure, especially by a preponderance of a young population, and especially since Iraq is a very well-educated country. I just wonder whether that's a force that should be really taken into consideration.
The force, or an example, you mean, in the dissent in Iran?
That's right, or the idea that the people in Iraq may be beyond the point where they see such a great value in a religious government, mm-hmm. they may be interested in seeing a secular government based on the recent failures that they've seen in religious governments.
Harry, it's a great question, and thank you for raising it. Juan Cole, let me turn to you a couple of things there. First, is it possible that in this kind of chaotic post-regime period that that a small number of highly organized religious leaders may have undue influence? They may actually overrule a secular impulse that we've seen historically in Iraq. And secondly, what about Iran's role and example here? Is it going to try and push a Shia government in Baghdad?
Yeah. Well, I began by saying that I thought that the secular Shiites and the secular Iraqis were being underplayed in all this. So I agree with the basic point. However, what I think is important to underline is that the religious parties, by virtue of their popularity and their militias, are moving into a power vacuum that the fall of the Ba'ath Party has created, and getting them back out once they've taken over is not going to be easy. How could you send Marines into a slum like Sadr City and expect to have them disarm the militias that are loyal to the Shiite clergy? Mm-hmm. So I think that facts on the ground are being created, which may be difficult to reverse. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that the rhythms of a country are different. Iraqis are reacting against the excesses of a secular Arab nationalism under Saddam Hussein, and they're going to react against the idea of being at least briefly ruled by a foreign power, the United States, because they spent the 20th century getting out from under British rule. And Iranians of this generation, the younger people in Iran, are reacting against 20 years of a Khomeinist religious theocracy.
So they're at different points in the cycle.
Sort of. I think the attractions of an Islamic Republic, whatever that might mean to them, among the Iraqi Shiite religious people, are very great. And that's been very clear from all of the press reporting we've seen. I think that you can't depend on them, looking at Iran and saying, "Well, that's been a failure. We don't want to try it here." They might think, "Well, we can do a better job of it."
And what about Tehran's influence in this unfolding scene in Iraq?
Well, Iraqi Shia are Arabs, and for the most part, and are tend to be Iraqi nationalists, and so they're not going to slavishly follow Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some groups that have strong ties to Iran, which were given
refuge there
by Iran, and those ties may not disappear tomorrow. So it's a mixed bag. I think someone like Ayatollah Sistani, who's the foremost religious scholar in the holy city of Najaf, and is widely respected and followed in Iraq, is an ethnic Iranian, but he doesn't agree with the stances of Ali Khamenei, the leader of the supreme jurisprudent of Iran. So what Mahmoud was saying before about Najaf reemerging as a separate and powerful in its own right source of religious authority is true,
and an alternate to Iran's,
and an alternative to the mainstream political currents among the hardliners in Iran. And it shouldn't be forgotten that even though the majority of the Iranian population has demonstrated by its votes that it's now liberalizing, the 15% or so who are hardliners still control the army, the secret police, the press, the judiciary, and so on and so forth. So Iran has by no means been liberated from the hardliners.
And another example of where hardliners stepped into a power vacuum with the fall of the Shah of Iran, Andy's calling from Lincoln, Rhode Island. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I just want to show my concern towards what's going on nowadays in Iraq, especially the resurgence of the Islamic fervor and things. As an original Christian, Iraqi Christian, actually, who left 30-some years ago, I just by declaring, if ever happened that Iraq was declared as an Islamic state or start using Islamic Sharia and things, it's automatically classifying the Christians of Iraq, which number about 8%, automatically second-class citizens. I'd like to know what's,
Can I?
We understand the concern, Andy. Thanks for calling. Now, I've heard a smaller number than 8%, but in any case, there is a Christian population. Mahmoud Ayoub, what would you anticipate for a Christian population if things go this way?
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, if we take the Iran example, the Christian population in Iran is not doing badly. The Armenians and so on. The Christian population in Iraq will not do badly. I think whatever happens, because they are nationalists, they are part of the mix, and they are small enough not to create a problem for any group. I don't think that the Christians would worry unless there is an ultra-conservative Islamic State. But by the way, I don't think that many Muslims around the world would view Iran as a failure. That's, you know, we may think here that Iran, the Iranian government was a failure. But for many Muslims, Sunnis and Shias, Iran is not a failure. The fact that they vote democratically, that the hardliners are challenged and the students yield so much power, I think they are showing far more democracy than many Muslim countries in the Middle East and elsewhere.
That may well be, though. We at the same time hear a lot of frustrated dissent inside Iran. Juan Cole, I want to just turn to you here. You've got the ear, let's say, of Jay Garner or President Bush. How do you advise them on how best to deal with, channel?
Good luck to you.
Juan Cole, how to optimize where we are now?
What an unlikely scenario. But yes, assuming that I had their ear, I would say that Mahmoud is absolutely right. The main problem with what America is trying to do in Iraq is that the United States and Britain lack legitimacy for this task. So you'd have to bring in the United Nations. I was saying that you should move it out of the Pentagon at least. I think the United Nations has done some excellent work in this regard. They stepped in Cambodia and put it back on a good track. And so I think you need to involve more than just a Pentagon team, because, as I said, the major players on the Shiite side are not even coming to Jay Garner's conferences. They're boycotting him.
So heads up, we've got a problem here. Juan Cole, Mahmoud Ayoub, we're going to have you both back on to get deeper into this, and I'm sure we're going to have that opportunity. But I want to thank you both for joining me tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Juan Cole is professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of Sacred Space and Holy War. And Mahmoud Ayoub is professor of Islamic Studies at Temple University and author of Redemptive Suffering in Islam. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, actor Tim Robbins speaks out on dissent in America. This is On Point. Actor Tim Robbins has been one of Hollywood's most outspoken critics of the war in Iraq. Along with his wife, actress Susan Sarandon, he has also been one of the most vilified figures by supporters of the war. Even the Baseball Hall of Fame has disinvited the pair, who were scheduled to speak in Cooperstown this week on the 15th anniversary of the movie Bull Durham. Over the weekend, Tim Robbins spoke at the National Press Club in Washington about what he called a chill wind that is stifling American dissent. Here are excerpts from that speech.
In the 19 months since 9/11, we have seen our democracy compromised by fear and hatred. Basic inalienable rights, due process, the sanctity of the home have been quickly compromised in a climate of fear. This past weekend, Susan and I and the three kids went to Florida for a family reunion of sorts. Amidst the alcohol and the dancing, sugar-rushing children, there was, of course, talk of the war. And the most frightening thing about the weekend was the amount of times we were thanked for speaking out against the war, because that individual speaking thought it unsafe to do so in their own community, in their own life. "Keep talking," they said. I haven't been able to open my mouth. A relative tells me that a history teacher tells his 11-year-old son, my nephew, that Susan Sarandon is endangering the troops by her opposition to the war. Another teacher in a different school asks our niece if we are coming to the school play. They're not welcome here, said the molder of young minds. Another relative tells me of a school board decision to cancel a civics event that was proposing to have a moment of silence for those who have died in the war because the students were including dead Iraqi civilians in their silent prayer. And a friend of the family tells of listening to the radio down south as the talk radio host calls for the murder of a prominent anti-war activist. Relatives of ours have received threatening emails and phone calls, and my 13-year-old boy, who has done nothing to anybody, has recently been embarrassed and humiliated by a sadistic creep who writes, or rather scratches, his column with his fingernails in dirt. A famous middle-aged rock and roller called me last week to thank me for speaking out against the war, only to go on to tell me that he could not speak himself because he fears repercussions from Clear Channel. They promote our concert appearances, he said. They own most of the stations that play our music. I can't come out against this war. And here in Washington, Helen Thomas finds herself banished to the back of the room and uncalled on after asking Ari Fleischer whether our showing prisoners of war at Guantanamo Bay on television violated the Geneva Convention. A chill wind is blowing in this nation. A message is being sent through the White House and its allies in talk radio and Clear Channel and Cooperstown. If you oppose this administration, there can and will be ramifications. In this time when a citizenry applauds the liberation of a country as it lives in fear of its own freedom, when people all over the country fear reprisal if they use their right to free speech, it is time to get angry. It is time to get fierce. And it doesn't take much to shift the tide. My 11-year-old nephew mentioned earlier, a shy kid who never talks in class, stood up to his history teacher who was questioning Susan's patriotism. That's my aunt you're talking about. Stop it. And the stunned teacher backtracked and began stammering compliments in embarrassment. Sports writers across the country reacted with such overwhelming fury at the Hall of Fame that the president of the Hall admitted he made a mistake and Major League Baseball disavowed any connection to the actions of the Hall's president. A bully can be stopped, and so can a mob. It takes one person with the courage and a resolute voice.
Actor and director Tim Robbins speaking at the National Press Club over the weekend. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sabi Mir and Chris O'Connor. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.